Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce Marilyn Pinsky, as she will introduce this morning's speaker. Marilyn said she has been a member of TMR forever, as she seems to remember Millard Fillmore or Thomas Dewey being a speaker and talking about building a thruway through Syracuse, which we all said wouldn't happen. She's the former commissioner of the Onondaga Department of Aging and Youth, past president of the New York State AARP, and has been very involved in the community. She has 3 great children, 7 wonderful grandchildren, a boyfriend, and that's about it. Please join me in welcoming Marilyn Pinsky.
Emily has been just wonderful, and I cannot thank Emily and Bea and TMR enough for letting me do this. My children and I do this lecture because Philip was very involved in this community, and we want his name and his memory to live on. My family who are here today is my daughter, Lauren Craig, my son-in-law, Mark Craig, our son, Brad Pinsky. Right. Yesterday I took Reese for an interview at one of the stations, and I said, my name's Marilyn Pinsky. And he said, boy, that was house fire in Manlius was really big. I thought, do all the fire chiefs call their mother except mine to say, boy, that was a great fire, you know? And Chief Pinsky's wife, my daughter-in-law, Nicole. Our daughter, Debbie, whose birthday it is today, lives in Albany, and she couldn't be here today. I met Reese Ehrlich last year when I traveled to Iran with a New York Times journey trip. And he was the expert that the Times hired to accompany the group. He has reported from and about the Middle East for years. And in Iran, he seemed to be known as the man who brought Sean Penn to Iran. He really lives the life that you would imagine of someone who covers the world's danger spots and interviews everyone from politicians to the man on the street to terrorists. It is amazing that as an American journalist, he's able to have sit-downs with terrorists, and I guess you sort of have to have the credibility and imagine Reese in local dress. And I remember he said to me, it's all about the shoes. You have to have dirty sandals. You can't wear American shoes to go to these places. So you have to imagine him in a robe and dirty sandals. I forgot to introduce, by the way, that's the boyfriend sitting over there with my kids, Marvin. Reese is a freelance journalist, the author of best-selling books, including books on Iraq and Syria. He writes for many major news publications and can be found in real life on PBS and CBS. He has been leading trips to Cuba since first visiting there in 1968. And if you want to go, he has room on one that's coming up in January, and you can talk to him about it because he'll be hanging around a little bit after speech to sign books if you'd like to buy a book or sign up to go to Cuba or Iran or wherever the spirit takes you. For those of us who are old enough to remember, Reese was one of the Oakland Seven, and he reminded me to please say that they were acquitted of all charges. And as far as I know, he hasn't been arrested since. Right, well, okay. A book reviewer said of him, some people are treated as pariahs when they tell the truth. Later, history lauds them for their courage and convictions. Reese Ehrlich is one of those truth tellers.
I want to thank Marilyn for that unique introduction, and thank her for bringing me here. This is my first time in Syracuse. I have this tradition with each of my 5 books I wear a different hat. So this is my new hat from Italy. It was a gift from my father. And we sat down one time and he said, my boy, I give you this hat from Sicilia. I give you three things, the clump of dirt from our farm, a cutting for the vine, for the wine that we want to grow, and this hat. And I turned to him with a tear in my eye. I said, Pop, why are you talking this way? We're Jewish. Okay, so much for the hat joke. I'm going to start on a more serious note with a hypothetical. What if some country in the Middle East had invited one of its nationals to a consulate in a third country and had murdered him, dismembered him, and then lied about it and came up with five different stories to try to explain what had happened? And then the CIA found out that the head of that country had ordered the murder of this dissident journalist. And what if that country was Iran and not Saudi Arabia? What would the reaction in the United States have been? We would be on the verge of war. How dare Iran engage in this kind of human rights violation? Look at the repression, et cetera, et cetera. Instead, what do we get out of the White House? Well, maybe Ben Salman did it, maybe he didn't. But in any case, and I have to say, President Trump is honest. He straightforwardly says, we don't care about human rights. We don't care about what's right and wrong. It's oil. Saudi Arabia provides oil and buys our armaments, and that's why we're going to continue the relations with them. Now, we don't have to speculate too much on what the reaction in the United States would have been had this been Iran, because a little over 5 years ago, the U.S. accused Iran of plotting to murder the Saudi ambassador to Washington, D.C. And they said an Iranian national and an Iranian American were part of this plot to bomb, carry out a bombing. And after the U.S. announced that this plot had existed, but before there was any trial, letter, or conviction, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution by 92 votes calling on President Obama to crush the Central Bank of Iran. So the level of hypocrisy, of double standards is quite well known. If you're an ally of the United States and provide oil and buy our arms, you can get away with anything. If you are a enemy of the United States, declared by out of Washington, well, then we can pretty much accuse you of anything and get away with it. And I'm going to get into greater detail of that in a moment. But first, I wanted to show you a video that I shot in December of last year. Actually, it was not a couple months after the trip that Marilyn and I and others took. And it was at the time when the nuclear accord had been agreed upon, but Trump had not yet pulled out.
My name is Reese Ehrlich, and I'm here on assignment for the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. We're standing in front of the famous Tehran Bazaar. On my last trip, I stopped to ask people what they thought about the nuclear accord. I'm back to find out what they think about Trump's latest policies.
For this reason, upon taking office, I've ordered a complete strategic review of our policy toward the rogue regime in Iran.
When reporting from Iran, I always like to do random interviews with ordinary people. That's how I met Masoud Nashabeghi, who sells textiles in the bazaar.
What do you think of Trump's policies now?
He only thinks of himself, and he wants to be in full control of all the countries in the world, and he has an old animosity with Iran.
Virtually every Iranian I interviewed condemned Trump's policies and expressed anger that, despite having a signed nuclear accord, the U.S. is imposing new sanctions that hurt the economy for ordinary people.
Just before what would have been the total collapse of the Iranian regime.
University of Tehran assistant professor Fouad Azadeh says Iran has held up its end of the nuclear agreement. Iran disabled a nuclear reactor, shipped enriched uranium out of the country, and restricted its production of nuclear fuel. international weapons inspectors have reported numerous times that Iran is adhering to the agreement. But the Trump administration continually imposes new sanctions on Iran.
So a lot of people in Iran are asking, you're getting sanctions before the agreement and you're getting sanctions after the agreement. So what's the use of accepting what the U.S. wants you to accept?
U.S. sanctions have hurt Iran's economy, but so has Iranian government corruption, mismanagement, and misallocation of funds. Tens of thousands of mostly young workers demonstrated against the government starting in late December 2017 and lasting into January. Electrician Arya Khosravi says the government wastes billions of dollars on Middle East wars, money it should use to create jobs at home.
Oh, I think it's the fault of our own politicians with creating tensions and the issues with Palestine and Syria and Iraq.
Many Iranians are critical of both their own government and the Trump administration. Back at the bazaar, I asked textile salesman Nashabegi if he thinks Trump will pull out of the nuclear agreement. He says the 5+1 countries, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, and China, have also signed the agreement, so the U.S. will have a hard time pulling out.
Well, if he does, it's to his own disadvantage, because it will just show all the European nations that he is an untrustworthy character.
For the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, I'm Reese Ehrlich, Tehran.
So you see from that what happened in spring of this year was the Trump administration actually withdrew from the nuclear accord. And it's important to note that that was an agreement not just between the Iran and the United States, but between seven countries. It was passed unanimously by the UN Security Council, became part of international law. So when the U.S. pulled out, it was not only a slap in the face to Iran, but to Germany and France and Russia and China and Britain, all the other countries that signed the agreement, and sets an incredibly bad precedent for the world, because why should any other country, whether it be North Korea or China or anyone else, believe the United States when it enters into agreement if the next president comes along and can pull out? We hear a lot about the danger of Iran in the region, that it's a brutal power, it represses its own people, it engages in supporting terrorism, and was on the verge of building a nuclear weapon. What you don't hear is the fact that according to the CIA, the NSA, and all the other major U.S. intelligence agencies, Iran had no nuclear weapons program since 2003. The Iranians say they never had one. And we stop and think about it. Think of all the propaganda we got about, oh my God, they're just months away from a breakout point when they could have a nuclear weapon. If that was such a danger, why did the CIA and others note and prove in not one but two different national intelligence estimates that Iran had no nuclear weapons program? And the reason is basically that the administrations in Washington, both Democrat and Republican, it's not a partisan issue, needed to find an issue to get people very, very worried about Iran. And the nuclear weapons issue proved to be the perfect case. We saw it in another context with Iraq. We all remember the weapons of mass destruction, and Saddam Hussein was another Hitler, and all of this propaganda that wound people up to support the 2003 invasion of Iraq. Well, it didn't work then. We know it was a false argument. And the folks in power in Washington today are the same folks who brought us the Iraq War. John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, the key national security advisors and people are neoconservatives, ultra-right-wing sector of the Republican Party, that still think the Iraq War was a great idea. They think somehow we had a great victory in Iraq. And now they're getting ready to try it all over again with Iran. So the withdrawal from the nuclear accord from Iran and imposition of sanctions on Iran is about an effort to destabilize Iran and affect regime change. It's not the official policy, but it doesn't take too much reading between the lines when you read John Bolton that's in fact the goal. And I don't think we're going to see another Iraq war in the sense of an invasion and occupation. What we're going to see is sanctions, or what they plan to do anyway, is to crank up the sanctions to put the squeeze on ordinary Iranians, because they know, despite all the rhetoric, sanctions are supposed to be affecting only the top leaders, but in reality it hurts ordinary Iranians because they can't get medicines, they can't get medical supplies, certain food products are hard to get. The economy goes south. You sponsor terrorist attacks on the fringes through the ethnic minorities in Iran, and eventually the people of Iran rise up as one and bring in a pro-U.S. regime. That's the plan out of Washington. Now, it's completely disattached from reality, but it's a very dangerous policy. It puts U.S. national security at risk, and it makes for horrible conditions for ordinary Iranians. Now, I will talk in a moment about the very real problems in Iran, the very real awful policies the Iranian government carries out. But keep in mind that the U.S. solution for this is to make the situation worse. So I mentioned, and Marilyn mentioned, that I had taken Sean Penn to Iran in 2005. I got a call from a friend of mine, Norman Solomon, with whom I had written a book, and he was with Sean at his house then in Marin County in California. He said, Sean wants to go to Iran and understand what ordinary people think of Iran, and ordinary people think of the Iranian government and the U.S. government. And would you like to come? We know you've been to Iran before. And I took several nanoseconds and said, yeah, let's go. And I went over and briefed him. We had quite a few meetings. And ultimately, we got there in 2005 at the time of the presidential elections, when ultimately Ahmadinejad was elected for the first time. So it was an interesting experience, because he did not go as a movie star, but he had asked me during the briefings, would people know my work over there? I said, oh yeah, they're gonna know your work. Even though American films are not allowed to play in the movie theaters, there's a vigorous DVD, underground DVD movement. You have what are called DVD men that come to your house, they're like a walking video store. You remember what a video store was, right? And they would bring a DVD and you would rent it for a week, and they come to know what films you like, and they bring you more. So if you wanted to specialize in Sean Penn films, you could get them, because virtually anything was available as in the underground DVD market. So we were one day interviewing people in the Tehran Bazaar. You saw the scenes from the bazaar in the video. And Norman and I were interviewing one guy, and Sean was over interviewing somebody else. And then he came over to join us. And the merchant we were talking to was completely flummoxed. He says, oh my gosh, I know who you are. You're Sean Penn. You used to be married to Madonna. Just what he wanted to hear. So in the course of our travels with him and my total of 10 trips that I've made to Iran, it seems kind of counterintuitive, but the Iranian people are actually very friendly to Americans. I'll be standing on a street corner or in a museum talking in English, and someone will come up in English and say, oh, where are you from? I say, I'm from San Francisco. I'm actually from Oakland. But nobody's ever heard of Oakland, so I say, I'm from San Francisco. And they say, oh, I have a cousin in Los Angeles. You know, I have a brother in New York, or whatever. And it's a genuine friendliness. They invite you over for lunch or for dinner. It's a genuine openness, partly because they're very open people and friendly to strangers, partly because there's fond memories. Many Iranians lived in the United States as students in the 70s, some of whom have gone back, some of whom have stayed, but they've got a lot of ties. And what's interesting is that they really do make a distinction between the people of the United States and the government policy. It's a genuine, you know, they will ask me probably one of the toughest questions I'm ever asked, which is, why did Americans elect Trump? So think about how you explain that in two sentences. All right. But I would do my best to explain and so on, and we have interesting discussions. Now, think about it in the United States. When we have an enemy country that we want to demonize, whether it's Iraq or Iran or you name it, there's an overdrive effort to demonize the entire people. The Iraqis and the Afghanis are not just victims of bad governments. They are terrorists. Think of the Hollywood movies where the enemies were the communists for a long time, and then they became maybe the Latin American drug lords, and now, and then it was Arab terrorists, and now it's Muslim terrorists. But there's little distinction made between the policies of the government of that country and the ordinary people. And I think that's a very negative reflection about how the two countries operate. I mentioned that the I was going to mention some of the criticisms that I have of the government of Iran itself. Just because the United States has demonized Iran doesn't make what the Iranian government is doing is correct or good. Most notably, there are severe human rights violations there, the rights of women, the rights of workers, ethnic minorities. You think of Iran as being one nation of Persians. Sometimes you'll hear Iran referred to as Persians. Well, that's the dominant nationality. But there are Kurds, Arab Iranians, Baluchis, people who live in the southeast of the country over by Pakistan, and they suffer discrimination. They're not allowed to speak or get educated in their own languages or have media in their own languages or have local officials from their own ethnicity. And there's a great deal of resentment against Tehran for those policies. More recently, in December of last year, January of this year, there were huge demonstrations mostly by working class folks in 80 cities around Iran. And they carried out massive demonstrations for about 2 weeks. They were brutally crushed by the government. And the economic demands had to do with things like not having been paid for 2 or 3 months or having a factory shut down and you not being paid at all. People were justifiably and understandably outraged at that. And anything that any movement in Iran faces severe repression and as a result becomes political. So the economic demands very quickly became down with the dictator. People resented the money being spent in Syria or Iraq for sending troops over there, the number of Iranians killed in that war. And people were chanting slogans that said basically bring our boys home. And quite legitimately so. More recently, you probably haven't heard about this unless you're a specialist in Iran, there was a teacher's strike, a strike of truck drivers, and just a couple days ago, the National Steel Company, it's a nationalized company, they went on strike for wages and hours and wages and working conditions. So there's a lot of discontent in Iran and a lot of legitimate anger at the government. The sanctions are part of the problem because they squeeze ordinary people. Part of the problem is mismanagement and corruption. There's massive corruption in Iran, partly when you go to avoid sanctions. The people who are avoiding the sanctions have to engage in clandestine activities. So, for example, if you want to bring in spare parts for your machinery, the sanctions will not allow you to do it. So you find a third party who's willing to sell it to you at an inflated price, and then you have to smuggle it in. Well, that means probably paying in cash. Literally, they will load reals or dollars into a suitcase, take it to Dubai, deposit it, and so on. So whenever you're dealing in that kind of situation, it's rife potential for corruption. So you're supposed to get $1 million worth of goods, and you deliver 800,000, and you keep 200,000 for yourself. You get the idea how corruption can easily multiply in that situation. So it's a very serious problem. Iranian, everybody knows it's a problem in Iran, and people are very angry at it. But you know, in all of my, and by the way, the Washington and the Trump administration highlights these kind of things and says, see, look how unjust the system is in Iran. The people want democracy. They want a U.S.-style system. And in all of my years of now almost 20 years traveling to Iran, interviewing hundreds of people, I have yet to meet a single Iranian who wants to have a U.S.-style system in Iran. And they will say to me, you know, oh, you want to bring a democracy to Iran. Now, is that the democracy that you brought to Iraq or the democracy that you brought to Afghanistan or maybe Libya? The people of Iran are not dumb. They see what U.S. policy, they see the rhetoric of U.S. policy, and then they see the reality of U.S. policy. And if anything, U.S. has given democracy a bad name because we attach all these policies with the idea of democracy. Besides which, the Iranians have direct experience with the process of having a pro-U.S. bringing democracy to Iran. It was 1953. In 1953, there was a parliamentary system in Iran. There were free elections. There were freedom of the press, freedom to organize trade unions, women's rights movement, freedom of religion, and it was led by Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh was a nationalist. He was a leftist. He was not a communist, but he was a popularly elected prime minister. That government decided to nationalize British Petroleum, or the company that was later known as British Petroleum, BP. And they said, we're going to take 50% of the profits of the oil companies because you cheated us when the initial deal, which was in the early 1900s, a British oil company discovered the oil and bribed the local Shah, the king at the time, and set it up so that the British had the monopoly on control of Iranian oil at prices set by the British. And this is because none other than Winston Churchill had set up this system, because he was the head of the Navy in Britain at the time, and they were converting the British Navy from coal to oil-powered. And they needed oil because they didn't have oil in Britain, and Iran was the first country in the Middle East to discover oil, and they had to sell it all to Britain on British terms. Well, the Iranians said, that's not fair. We want 50% of the profits from the oil, and we're basically renegotiating the deal. Well, the British, of course, were outraged. We cheated you fair and square. How dare you nationalize? So the Iranians said, okay, we're going to take 100% of the oil. We're going to take the whole thing. Oh, well, they went completely ballistic, and they set up a naval blockade of the port where the oil was exported. They went to Truman and said, you've got to help us. Truman said, no dice, this is your problem. But then when Eisenhower was elected in 52, you may recall the Dulles brothers. And the Dulles brothers were, the British made the argument, well, it's not really all about oil. It's about communism. And Mossadegh is weak. And if he stays in power, the communists are going to take over, and the Soviet Union will dominate Iran or even take it over directly. We have to do something. Sound familiar? Which is that you find, first you have a policy of what you want to do, and then you find the excuse to justify the policy, as opposed to the other way around. And the CIA sent Kermit Roosevelt, who was the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, with $1 million in cash into Tehran. $1 million in those days was a lot of money. And he's just started handing it out. And the U.S. then proceeded to use every terrorist tactic in the book to overthrow the legitimate government of Iran. They did false flag operations, they did bombings, assassinations, you name it. And ultimately, the U.S. Overthrew the government and installed the Shah. The Shah was a brutal dictator. He set up the SAVAK, the secret police, with U.S. assistance, but he was a pro-U.S. dictator, so he was okay, and he was a modernizer. In one of my radio documentaries and in my book, I talk about how the U.S. media covered this, and I dug up an old New York radio broadcast that right after the coup, and the announcer says, the general so-and-so has come back to power in Iran, and the Iranian oil is flowing west again, dun dun dun, with a crescendo of music. So it was portrayed as this successful fight against communism. I speak a lot in Washington. I talk to liberal think tanks, conservative think tanks, conferences of all kinds. And what I notice is there's a huge disconnect when looking at history and the consequences of U.S. actions. So 1953, the overthrow of Mossadegh and the installation of the Shah. 1979, mass movement revolution overthrows the Shah, and the current conservative religious government comes to power. In Washington, there's no connection between the two things. 1953 is over here. Oh, 1979 is over here. In reality, there was a direct connection. If the Shah had not been in power, if the government had been allowed to continue democracy, democratic elections, the folks in power now would have not come to power. Same thing happens in Iraq. The U.S. invades Iraq in 2003, occupies the country. There's anger, there's guerrilla movements, there's opposition, armed opposition. One of the groups would later be known as the Islamic State, who took over parts of northern Syria and Iraq, as we know in later years. Is there any connection between the U.S. occupation of Iraq and Islamic? Oh, no, two separate things. Somehow the Sunnis and Shias have always been fighting, and blah, 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 you know, and we have all these other explanations. In reality, the Islamic State would not exist had not the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq. But Washington refuses to recognize any continuity or connection, because that might just lead you to conclude that we shouldn't have gotten involved in the war in the first place. And we certainly don't want to reach that conclusion. I want to talk just a bit about Iran and Israel. I know that's an issue of concern, as it well should be. The Netanyahu government argues that Iran is an existential threat to Israel, that it's anti-Semitic mullahs in charge. They hate the Jews, and particularly if they ever got an atomic weapon, it would justify, they would attack Israel, or the potential is to attack Israel, and we cannot possibly let that happen. Imagine if in the 30s people had done something to stop Hitler and the Holocaust, how that would have changed history, and we face a similar situation today. He opposed very strongly the nuclear accord and cheered Trump when he pulled out earlier this year. But there's another view in Israel, and that's, I've interviewed current and former government officials, think tank folks, experts in academia, and the other view is, well, no, actually, Netanyahu is exaggerating the Iranian threat exactly the same way that Trump does. These folks argue, if Iran is such a threat, an existential threat to Israel, why hasn't it already attacked Israel with conventional weapons? It has missiles capable of reaching Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and other cities. It could cause a lot of damage. It has not done so since 1979. Why? Because they realize that an attack on Israel would give Israel and the United States exactly the excuse they've been waiting for to flatten Iran and flatten Tehran and bring another government to power. And the mullahs who run Iran may be evil, but they're not crazy. They're not self-destructive. And the folks I talked to in Israel recognize that and will say, now, it's interesting, if they're in government, they won't say it. But when they get out of government, they'll say it. And they acknowledge that the whole atomic weapons issue and the threat of atomic weapons is exaggerated in order to have a particular political aim. Let me read you a quote. "I think that the countries who negotiated with Iran were right in reaching a resolution which is embodied in the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, that is the nuclear accord, which is an imperfect understanding but is preferable to a situation of no understanding. It was the first step in the right direction. I think that the prospect that those who have initiated the prospects of confronting Iran militarily is becoming a viable option with disastrous consequences. You know how to begin a war, but never know how to end a war." And that comes from Ephraim Halevi, the head of Mossad from 1998 to 2002. Mossad, of course, is the CIA in Israel. So there are certainly numerous opinions in Israel about Iran, and particularly the nuclear issue. Now, what are the real issues if the nuclear weapon is not the danger that it's portrayed to be? Iran has its own hegemonic ends in the region. It supports the Hezbollah political party and militia in Lebanon. It supports Bashar al-Assad in Syria. It supports certain factions within the government in Iraq. And of course, it supports Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Palestine, among the Palestinians. And that's the real reason that there's antagonism between the two countries. The Israelis argue that if Iran was not providing weapons and arms and political and economic support to Hezbollah, for example, that they wouldn't face a threat on the northern border. That's the real reason. Now, it's hard to get either the Israeli people or the American people or indeed people around the world to support bombing, offensive bombing against Iran because of those issues. So you exaggerate the atomic threat, the atomic bomb threat, as a possible justification. But I have to say, and I don't want to get off into a whole discussion of Israel and Palestine today, although I'll be happy to answer a few questions. But if Iran disappeared tomorrow, it would not resolve the problems of Israel and Palestine. Iran is not the source of the problem. There's longstanding negotiations that need to take place for a two-state solution. The Iranians have indicated, both to me in interviews as well as publicly elsewhere, if the Palestinians decide on a two-state solution, they will agree as well. They're not in a position to dictate to the Palestinians that they should reject Israel negotiations or anything else. If the Palestinians decide to make peace, the Iranians will go along with it, and I think Israel and Palestine will be better off for it. At this point, I've mentioned all of the negative things, what's wrong with Washington, what's going on in Iran. You may feel like, I'm pretty pessimistic at this point. The things going on in the world are pretty miserable. I think I'll just go home and pull the covers up over my head and try and forget about all this or focus on the latest sports, or whatever. But I'm actually optimistic. Why would I be optimistic given everything that's coming out of Washington? Right? I see some head shaking. This guy's crazy. I'm from Oakland. The reason is because Trump's policies are really backfiring. They are having a tremendous impact around the world and at home, and people are getting wise to it. So let's start internationally. The Trump administration has attempted to impose the most severe sanctions ever on Iran, right? The November 4th, there was supposed to be the second round of sanctions imposed, and they publicly announced that Iran would be able to export zero oil. No oil would be exported from Iran. And that, if it happened, would be a serious blow because it's the number one export of Iran, it's the number one hard currency earner, and indeed would have been a major problem. November 4th comes around, the Trump administration announces they're giving waivers to 8 countries to allow them to export oil to Iran. Those 8 countries include the 3 top importers of Iranian oil, India, China, and Turkey. The Trump administration said, we're doing this so that oil prices won't spike. If you take Iranian oil off the market too soon, it'll drive up oil prices, and we don't want that to happen. The real reason was those countries were going to import the Iranian oil anyway, in defiance of the Trump administration. So they did it to make safe face. That's a pretty big deal, because remember, the U.S. pulling out of the agreement was unilateral. No other country in the world none of the countries that had signed the agreement were going along with it. The Europeans, particularly the French and the Germans, are setting up what's called a special vehicle in which they will import Iranian oil and export humanitarian goods, pharmaceuticals, food, and so on, to Iran. And it will be a barter system, not denominated in U.S. dollars. The dollar, of course, is the international currency for trade, and the U.S. asserts that any trade that takes place in dollars, even if it's by other countries, is subject to U.S. sanctions. So if you make a trade in dollars, you can be sued in U.S. federal courts. That's what they assert. And that really gets everybody ticked off, particularly the Europeans. And it's not the first time, by the way, the U.S. has done this. They did it around Cuba. Remember when the U.S. had a unilateral embargo that nobody else in the world supported against Cuba? They went after credit card companies in Britain, for example, who allowed British citizens to use credit cards in Cuba. So people are quite justifiably angry at a long-time assertion of U.S. power in order to basically carry out illegal activities. So we'll see what happens in January when it looks like this special vehicle is going to be set up in Germany. And we'll see how far it gets, but they're trying to export humanitarian goods as a first step to possibly doing other material as well. Meanwhile, the Russians and the Chinese are talking about not using the dollar for their trade, to use only local currency, and various countries are moving away from trying to use the dollar or continuing to use the dollar as an international currency. And that has tremendous impact, potential impact on the world economy. One of the reasons that we can borrow so much money is that we borrow for the federal deficit is because we borrow in dollars. Well, if suddenly we have to borrow in yen or euros or something like that, that has a tremendous implications for the U.S. economy and for inflation here and so on. So I'm not saying that's going to happen tomorrow, but there's very serious discussions going on, not just in the traditional enemies or hostile countries like Russia and China, but Germany, France, Britain. And by the way, these are conservative governments. These are not leftist governments in power. And on top of that, Trump has ticked off pretty much everybody in the world with his trade policies. You have Canada and Mexico, the conservative governments in Britain, Germany, France, You know, you keep going down the list, and every time things look like they might get better, he picks another fight on the grounds that, you know, it's America first, American nationalism. Well, inevitably, if you're putting your own interests first, it's to the detriment of these other countries, and they realize it. And the irony, of course, is that the whole world trade system that has been set up was for the benefit of U.S. corporations and the United States. It wasn't set up for these other countries. The U.S. has done very well in the trade agreements that have been set up, and now the Trump administration is pulling the plug on that. And then it turns around and expects cooperation. So it starts a trade war with China and then says, why aren't you pressuring North Korea? You know, or why aren't you pressuring Iran? Well, hello. All right. So internationally, the Trump policies are causing a lot of trouble and isolating him. Domestically, the same thing has happened. I think this, the midterm elections were very significant. It looks like now the Democrats will have a 40-seat majority in the House, not that something that hasn't existed since the 1970s. It really was a blue wave. There were significant changes in state legislatures and governors. Where I'm from in California, the Republicans lost every single statewide race, and they lost 7 out of 7 congressional seats that the Democrats had targeted for flipping. And these are places like Orange County and San Diego, very conservative parts of California, now have Democrats as representatives. And 2/3 of the state legislature, both the Senate and the Assembly, are now Democrat in California. And I think the prospects, now, the Democrats who are elected are not necessarily anti-interventionist. They vary from moderates to people who are self-declared socialists. There's a wide range within the Democratic Party. So we'll see how it sorts out in terms of their actual policies. One thing to watch, and I think is very significant, and again giving me hope and optimism, is this debate in the Senate about the war in Yemen. You may have seen that the Senate is now debating whether to invoke the War Powers Act to stop the U.S. intervention and support for Saudi Arabia and Yemen. The war in Yemen is a civil war. It's not a proxy war between the U.S. and between Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's a war that's been going on in one form or another for quite a few years, and the foreign intervention has simply made it worse. So the Senate is voting this week, if everything goes according to schedule, about whether to invoke the War Powers Act. The House of Representatives will probably vote in the next session. The very fact that this debate is coming up is significant. A recent opinion poll shows 75% of the American people oppose the war in Yemen, 57% oppose selling arms to Saudi Arabia. This is a big potential upheaval because the Trump administration has thrown everything it has into the fight to continue supporting Saudi Arabia. So the U.S.-Saudi relations are at a crisis point, largely because of the assassination of Khashoggi and the ongoing war in Yemen. So all of this leads me to be rather optimistic. The people who voted against Trump are not going away. White women, educated women, and white working class women, single moms, voted overwhelmingly against the Republicans because of Trump. 2020 comes along, those people aren't, Trump isn't going to change, and those people are not going to change. It was not based on local elections like you normally have. And I think if the Democrats don't blow it, if they get out and mobilize their base, I think we're going to see a very significant change in 2020. And with that, I'll say thank you and take questions.
Good morning. Super presentation. My question goes to, I'm not a fan of Trump. I'm not alone. But Arab Spring happened. Mm-hmm. Been nationalism. Been a lot of taking over governments across the world over the last 15 years or so. Is there something else going on throughout the world where people are looking for change or something? I just don't quite understand it all.
Sure, people are looking for change. Unfortunately, you can see change in two directions. You have the rise of these right-wing proto-fascist movements. We saw it in Charlottesville in the United States. We see it in Hungary, various parts of Europe, where using immigration as the issue, they try to use populist arguments to say, you know, the capitalists have been treating you bad. What's the problem? Immigrants. So we have to
crack down. But there's also a left movement around the world as well that says, no, the problem is not immigrants. The problem is the people running this country. And Tunisia is the one example from the Arab Spring that was successful. They got rid of their old dictator, pro-U.S. dictator. They held parliamentary elections. A conservative political Islamist party won. And then they lost the election, and they agreed to leave power. And, you know, it shows that you can have a parliamentary system without having a dictatorship or monarchy or a pro-U.S. dictatorship. So there's, in terms of change worldwide, there's those two trends. And we'll have to see, you know, who prevails in the years ahead.
Thank you very much for your remarks. I have had the opportunity to travel some in Iran, but I can't claim to have a deep understanding of that very interesting, complex country. But one of the things I think I understand, and I would welcome your correction, is that Iran is basically surrounded by hostile countries or countries that have, like, U.S. bases, which, of course, means hostile. But I also understand that Iran hasn't invaded another country in two centuries. Would you comment on my understanding? Did I get it right?
Basically, yes. The Iran actually was surrounded by hostile Afghanistan under the Taliban and hostile Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and the U.S. did them the favor of getting rid of both of those governments. And the governments that came to power, particularly in Iraq, is much more favorable to Iran and is as favorable to Iran as it is to the United States. It's absolutely true the U.S., Iran has not invaded anybody in centuries. It is, however, trainers, what do we call them? You know, people who are supposed to be training local militias. They have organized militias from Afghanistan and Iraq to fight in Syria. They're supporting Hezbollah. So they don't have to send large numbers of troops in an outright invasion. But they are a hegemonic power. I mean, they seek to have their influence in the region, which doesn't, in my mind, justify, therefore, the U.S. has to fight them. The best example that I can give you is that the people of the country will deal with Iran's presence in their own way. The party that won the plurality in the Iraqi elections in the spring was a party that condemned both U.S. and Iran for its policies inside Iraq. And there were big demonstrations in Basra, the southern city in Iraq, and they attacked the U.S. consulate there, which we heard about, but they also attacked the Iranian consulate. So the Iraqi people are not interested in the heavy hand of Iran any more than they are of the United States. I'll just leave it at that.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure having you in Syracuse. Does Iran have a navy, an army? Armed forces?
Of course.
And how well-equipped and trained are they?
Well, they have a traditional army and navy, but they also have the Revolutionary Guards, which were established after 79 because the new government didn't trust the old army. And let's take the navy. They have basically rely on guerrilla war-style tactics on the sea. They don't have aircraft carriers and massive battle ships and so on. They will put soldiers on speedboats, possibly load them with sea-to-sea missiles, and threaten. That poses a threat to other shipping in the region if they so decide to do. Their military is not set up to invade and occupy other countries, but it would be a formidable force if somebody tried to invade them.
Hi, just to ask your thoughts and background on this. Saudi Arabia is Sunni, Iran is Shia, Hamas, my understanding, is Sunni.
Yes.
Iran in some way is helping Hamas. Could you just talk a little about the Sunni-Shia split and the help that Iran is giving the Sunni entity Hamas?
Yeah, you're quite right, and it exposes the fact that it's not a Sunni versus Shia battle, as we're often told. Not only is Hamas Sunni, but Bashar al-Assad, the head of Syria, the president of Syria, who is supported by Iran, is an Alawite.
And despite what you might have heard, the Alawites are not Shia. And in any case, he's a secular dictator. I've interviewed him twice. He's a pan-Arabist. He's not motivated by religion. So it's not Sunni versus Shia. It's the same things that I described that interest the United States, interest the other countries in the region. You have some of the major oil exporting countries of the world in the region, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran, Kuwait, and others. You have military bases dotting the area. Each side wants to control. You have economic power of consumer markets and so on. And the Iranians support Hamas specifically because they see them as the trend within the Palestinian movement that they can most easily deal with. They're not the same branch of Islam, but they are Muslims. In fact, the Hamas was a Muslim Brotherhood creation back in the 70s. So it's a lot more complicated than Sunni versus Shia. What I will say and what I have observed is that both sides use religion to rally their troops. It's not the source of the problem, but when you go to Iran and you say, why are your troops in Syria? The ordinary Iranians told me, well, we're protecting the Shia shrines, which there are. There's a number of very important Shia shrines, and that's the justification that the government has given to its people. And in turn, in Saudi Arabia, when I interviewed people there, I said, you know, why are you supporting what you are? They say, oh, the Shia aren't even Muslims, and so we're protecting Islam. So those kind of arguments filter down to ordinary people, but they're not the source of the problem.
Thanks again for the presentation. Can you talk a bit about the relationship of Iran with China and Russia?
Iran is when the 1979 revolution took place, it was explicitly neither capitalism nor socialism, neither East nor West, and they were as hostile to the old Soviet Union as they were to the United States. But that has evolved over the years because, first of all, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore, and they have been forced to turn to country because of U.S. hostility and very difficult, rough sanctions imposed. They've turned particularly to China as a means. China has been willing to import Iranian oil and provide payments for it, although they hold it in Chinese banks. So there's closer economic ties between Russia, China, and Iran. They're not necessarily politically getting any closer because there's still basic ideological differences. China is, despite what you have heard, is run by a Marxist party with Marxist ideology. Iran is run by clergy with a very conservative Islamic ideology. But they find themselves on the same side because they're under attack by the U.S.
All right. Join me in thanking Reese Ehrlich.